Five on Kirin Island Again by Enid Blyton. Read by Jan Francis. Chapter 1. A Letter for George. Anne was trying to do some of her prep in a corner of the common room when her cousin George came bursting in. George was not a boy. She was a girl called Georgina. But because she had always wanted to be a boy, she insisted on being called George. So, George she was. She wore her curly hair cut short, and her bright blue eyes gleamed angrily now as she came towards Anne.
Anne, I've just had a letter from home, and what do you think? Father wants to go and live on my island to do some special work. And he wants to build a sort of tower or something in the castle yard.
The other girls looked up in amusement, and Anne held out her hand for the letter that George was waving at her. Everyone knew about the little island off Kirin Bay that belonged to George. Kirin Island was a tiny place with an old ruined castle in the middle of it, the home of rabbits and gulls and jackdaws. It had underground dungeons, in which George and her cousins had had one or two amazing adventures. It had once belonged to George's mother, and she had given it to George. And George was very fierce where her precious Kirin Island was concerned. It was hers. Nobody else must live there, or even land there, without her permission. And now, dear me, here was her father proposing to go to her island and even build some sort of workshop there. George was red with exasperation.
It's just like grown-ups. They go and give you things and then act as though the things were theirs all the time. I don't want father living on my island and building nasty, messy sheds and things there. Oh, George, you know your father is a very famous scientist who needs to work in peace, said Anne, taking the letter. Surely you can lend him your island for a bit. There are plenty of other places where he can work in peace, said George. Oh, dear, I was so hoping we could go and stay there in the Easter Halls, take our boat there and food and everything, just like we've done before. Now we shan't be able to, if father really does go there.
Anne read the letter. It was from George's mother. My darling George, I think I must tell you at once that your father proposes to live on Kirin Island for some little time in order to finish some very important experiments he is making. He will have to have some kind of building erected there, a sort of tower, I believe. Apparently, he needs a place where he can have absolute peace and isolation, and also, for some reason, where there is water all around him. The fact of being surrounded by water is necessary to his experiment. Now, dear, don't be upset about this. I know that you consider Kirin Island as your very own, but you must allow your family to share it, especially when it is for something as important as your father's scientific work. Father thinks you will be very pleased indeed to lend him Kirin Island, but I know your funny feeling about it, so I thought I had better write and tell you before you arrive home and see him installed there, complete with his tower. The letter then went on about other things, but Anne did not bother to read these. She looked at George.
Oh, George, I don't see why you mind your father borrowing Kirin Island for a bit. I wouldn't mind my father borrowing an island from me, if I was lucky enough to have one. Your father would talk to you about it first and ask your permission and see if you minded, said George sulkily. My father never does anything like that. He just does exactly as he likes, without asking anybody anything. I really do think he might have written to me himself. He just puts my back up.
You've got a back that is very easily put up, George, said Anne, laughing.
Oh, don't scowl at me like that.
I'm not borrowing your island without your gracious permission.
But George wouldn't smile back. She took her letter and read it again gloomily.
To think that all my lovely holiday plans are spoiled, she said. You know how super Kirin Island is at Easter time, all primroses and gorse and baby rabbits. And you and Julian and Dick were coming to stay, and we haven't stayed together since last summer when we went caravanning.
I know. It is hard luck, said Anne. It would have been wizard to go and stay on the island these halls. But perhaps your father wouldn't mind if we did. We needn't disturb him.
As if living on Kirin Island with father there would be the same as living there all by ourselves, said George scornfully. You know it would be horrid.
Well, yes. Anne didn't think, on the whole, that Kirin Island would be much fun with Uncle Quentin there. George's father was such a hot-tempered, impatient man. And when he was in the middle of one of his experiments, he was quite unbearable. The least noise upset him.
Oh, dear, how he will yell at the jackdaws to keep quiet and shout at the noisy gulls, said Anne, beginning to giggle. He won't find Kirin quite so peaceful as he imagines.
George gave a watery sort of smile. She folded up the letter and turned away.
Well, I think it's just the limit, she said. I wouldn't have felt so bad if only Father had asked my permission.
He'd never do that, said Anne. It just wouldn't occur to him. Now, George, don't spend the rest of the day brooding over your wrongs, for goodness sake. Go down to the kennels and fetch Timmy. He'll soon cheer you up.
Timothy was George's dog, whom she loved with all her heart. He was a big, scruffy brown mongrel dog, with a ridiculously long tail and a wide mouth that really seemed to smile. All the four cousins loved him. He was so friendly and loving, so lively and amusing, and he had shared so very many adventures with them all. The five of them had had many happy times together. George went to get Timmy. Her school allowed the children to keep their own pets. If it hadn't allowed this, it is quite certain that George would not have gone to boarding school. She could not bear to be parted from Timmy for even a day. Timmy began to bark excitedly as soon as she came near. George lost her sulky look and smiled. Dear Timmy, dear trustable Timmy, he was better than any person. He was always on her side, always her friend, whatever she did. And to Timmy, there was no one in the world so wonderful as George. They were soon going through the fields together, and George talked to Timmy, as she always did. She told him about her father borrowing Kirin Island. Timmy agreed with every word she said. He listened as if he understood everything, and not even when a rabbit shot across his path did he leave his mistress's side. Timmy always knew when George was upset. He gave her hand a few little licks every now and again. By the time that George was back at school again, she felt much better. She took Timmy into school with her, smuggling him in at her side door. Dogs were not allowed in the school building, but George, like her father, often did exactly as she liked. She hurried Timmy up to her dormitory. He scuttled under her bed quickly and lay down. His tail thumped the floor gently. He knew what this meant. George wanted the comfort of his nearness that night. He would be able to jump on her bed when lights were out and snuggle into the crook of her knees. His brown eyes gleamed with delight.
Now, lie quiet,
said George, and went out of the room to join the other girls. She found Anne, who was busy writing a letter to her brothers, Julian and Dick, at their boarding school.
I've told them about Kirin Island and your father wanting to borrow it, she said. Would you like to come and stay with us, George, these halls, instead of us coming to Kirin? Then you won't feel cross all the time because your father is on the island.
No, thanks, said George at once. I'm going home. I want to keep an eye on father. I don't want him blowing up Kirin Island with one of his experiments. You know he's messing about with explosives now, don't you? Oh, atom bombs or things like that, said Anne.
I don't know, said George.
Anyway, quite apart from keeping an eye on Father and my island, we ought to go and stay at Kirin to keep Mother company. She'll be all alone if Father's on the island. I suppose he'll take food and everything there.
Well, there's one thing. We shan't have to creep about on tiptoe and whisper if your father isn't at Kirin Cottage, said Anne. We can be as noisy as we like. Do cheer up, George.
But it took George quite a long time to get over the fit of gloom caused by her mother's letter. Even having Timmy on her bed each night, till he was discovered by an angry teacher, did not quite make up for her disappointment. The term ran swiftly on to its end. April came in, with sunshine and showers. Holidays came nearer and nearer. Anne thought joyfully of Kirin, with its lovely sandy beach, its blue sea, its fishing boats, and its lovely cliffside walks. Julian and Dick thought longingly of them too. This term, both they and the girls broke up on the same day. They could meet in London and travel down to Kirin together. Hooray! The day came at last. Trunks were piled in the hall. Cars arrived to fetch some of the children who lived fairly near. The school coaches drew up to take the others down to the station. There was a terrific noise of yelling and shouting everywhere. The teachers could not make themselves heard in the din. Anyone would think that every single child had gone completely mad, said one of them to another. Oh, thank goodness they're getting into the coaches. George, must you rush along the corridor at 60 miles an hour with Timmy barking his head off all the time?
Yes, I must, cried George. Anne, where are you? Do come and get into the coach. I've got Timmy. He knows it's holidays now. Come on, Tim.
Down to the station went the singing crowd of children. They piled into the train.
Bags either seat. Who's taken my bag? Get out, Hetty. You know you can't bring your dog in here with mine. They fight like anything. Hooray! The guard's blowing his whistle. We're off.
The engine pulled slowly out of the station, its long train of carriages behind it, filled to bursting with girls off for their holidays. Through the quiet countryside it went, through small towns and villages, and at last ran through the smoky outskirts of London.
The boys' train is due in 2 minutes before ours, said Anne, leaning out of the window, as the train drew slowly into the London station.
If it was punctual, they might be on our platform to meet us. Oh, look, George, look, there they are.
George hung out of the window too.
Hi, Julian, she yelled. Here we are. Hi, Dick, Julian.
Chapter 2. Back at Kirin Cottage. Julian, Dick, Anne, George and Timmy went straight away to have buns and ginger beer at the station tea room. It was good to be all together again. Timmy went nearly mad with joy at seeing the two boys. He kept trying to get onto their knees.
Look here, Timmy, old thing. I love you very much and I'm jolly glad to see you, said Dick. But that's twice you've upset my ginger beer all over me.
Has he behaved himself this term, George?
Fairly well, said George, considering. Hasn't he, Anne? I mean, he only got the joint out of the larder once, and he didn't do so much harm to that cushion he chewed. And if people will leave their galoshes all over the place, nobody can blame Timmy for having a good old game with them.
And that was the end of the galoshes, I suppose, said Julian with a grin. On the whole, Timmy, you have had a rather poor report. I'm afraid our Uncle Quentin will not award you the usual 25 pence we get for good reports.
At the mention of her father, George scowled.
I see George has not lost her pretty scowl,
said Dick in a teasing voice. Dear old George. We shouldn't know her unless she put on that fearsome scowl half a dozen times a day.
Oh, she's better than she was,
said Anne, hurrying to George's defence at once. George was not so touchy as she had once been when she was being teased. All the same, Anne knew that there might be sparks flying over her father taking Kirin Island these holidays, and she didn't want George to fly into a temper too soon. Julian looked at his cousin.
I say, old thing, you're not going to take this business of Kirin Island too much to heart, are you?
He said.
You've just got to realise that your father's a remarkably clever man, one of the finest scientists we've got. And I think that those kind of fellows ought to be allowed as much freedom as they like for their work. I mean, if Uncle Quentin wants to work on Kirin Island for some peculiar reason of his own, then you ought to be pleased to say, go ahead, Father.
George looked a little mutinous after this rather long speech. But she thought a great deal of Julian, and usually went by what he said. He was older than any of them, a tall, good-looking boy, with determined eyes and a strong chin. George scratched Timmy's head and spoke in a low voice.
All right, I won't go up in smoke about it, Julian, but I'm frightfully disappointed. I'd planned to go to Kirin Island ourselves, these holes.
Well, we're all disappointed, said Julian.
Buck up with your bun, old thing. We've got to get across London and catch the train for Kirin. We shall miss it if we don't look out.
Soon they were in the train for Kirin. Julian was very good at getting porters and taxis. Anne gazed admiringly at her big brother as he found them all corner seats in a carriage. Julian did know how to tackle things.
Do you think I've grown, Julian?
She asked him.
I did hope I'd be as tall as George by the end of this term, but she grew too.
Well, I should think you might be a quarter of an inch taller than last term, said Julian. You can't catch us up, Anne. You'll always be the smallest. But I like you small.
Look at Timmy putting his head out of the window as usual, said Dick. Timmy, you'll get grit in your eye. Then George will go quite mad with grief and think you're going blind.
Woof,
said Timmy and wagged his tail. That was the nice part about Timmy. He always knew when he was being spoken to, even if his name was not mentioned, and he answered at once. Aunt Fanny was at the station to meet them in the pony trap. The children flung themselves on her, for they were very fond of her. She was kind and gentle, and did her best to keep her clever, impatient husband from finding too much fault with the children.
"How's Uncle Quentin?"
asked Julian politely, when they were setting off in the trap.
"He's very well," said his aunt, "and terribly excited. Really, I've never known him to be so thrilled as he has been lately. His work has been coming along very successfully."
"I suppose you don't know what his latest experiment is?"
said Dick.
Oh, no, he never tells me a word, said Aunt Fanny. He never tells anyone anything while he is at work, except his colleagues, of course. But I do know it's very important. And I know, of course, that the last part of the experiment has to be made in a place where there is deep water all round. Don't ask me why, I don't know.
Look, there's Kirin Island,
said Anne suddenly. They had rounded a corner and had come in sight of the bay. Guarding the entrance to it was the curious little island topped by the old ruined castle. The sun shone down on the blue sea, and the island looked most enchanting. George looked earnestly at it. She was looking for the building, whatever it was, that her father said he needed for his work. Everyone looked at the island, seeking the same thing. They saw it easily enough. Rising from the centre of the castle, probably from the castle yard, was a tall, thin tower, rather like a lighthouse. At the top was a glass-enclosed room, which glittered in the sun.
"Oh, Mother! I don't like it! It spoils Kirin Island!"
said George in dismay.
Darling, it can come down when your father has finished his work, said her mother. It's a very flimsy, temporary thing. It can easily be pulled down. Father promised me he would scrap it as soon as his work was done. He says you can go across and see it if you like. It's really rather interesting.
Oh, I'd love to go and see it, said Anne at once. It looks so strange. Is Uncle Quentin all alone on Kirin Island, Aunt Fanny?
Yes, I don't like him to be alone, said her aunt. For one thing, I am sure he doesn't get his meals properly. And for another, I'm always afraid some harm might come to him when he's experimenting. And if he's alone, how would I know if anything happened to him?
Well, Aunt Fanny, you could always arrange for him to signal to you each morning and night, couldn't you?
Said Julian sensibly.
He could use that tower easily. He could flash a signal to you in the morning using a mirror, you know, heliographing that he was all right. And at night, he could signal with a lamp. Easy.
Yes, I did suggest that sort of thing, said his aunt. I said I'd go over with you all tomorrow to see him. And perhaps, Julian, dear, you could arrange something of the sort with your uncle. He seems to listen to you now.
Gracious! Do you mean to say Father wants us to invade his secret lair and actually to see his strange tower? Asked George, surprised. Well, I don't think I want to go. After all, it's my island, and it's horrid to see someone else taking possession of it.
Oh, George, don't begin all that again, said Anne with a sigh. You and your island. Can't you even lend it to your own father?
Aunt Fanny, you should have seen George when your letter came. She looked so fierce that I was quite scared. Everyone laughed, except George and Aunt Fanny. She looked distressed. George was always so difficult. She found fault with her father and got up against him time after time. But dear me, how very, very like him she was, with her scowls, her sudden temper and her fierceness. If only George was as sweet-tempered and as easy-going as these three cousins of hers. George looked at her mother's troubled face and felt ashamed of herself. She put her hand on her knee.
It's all right, Mother. I won't make a fuss. I'll try and keep my feelings to myself. Really, I will. I know Father's work is important. I'll go with you to the island tomorrow.
Julian gave George a gentle clap on the back.
Good old George. She's actually learned not only to give in, but to give in gracefully. George, you're more like a boy than ever when you act like that.
George glowed. She liked Julian to say she was like a boy. But Anne looked a little indignant.
It isn't only boys that can learn to give in decently and things like that, she said. Heaps of girls do. Well, I jolly well hope I do myself.
My goodness, here's another firebrand, said Aunt Fanny, smiling. Stop arguing now, all of you. Here's Kirin Cottage. Doesn't it look sweet with all the primroses in the garden and the wallflowers coming out and the daffodils peeping everywhere? It certainly did. The four children and Timmy tore in at the front gate, delighted to be back. They clattered into the house and, to their great delight, found Joanna, the old cook, there. She had come back to help for the holidays. She beamed at the children and fondled Timmy when he leapt round her barking.
Well, there now, haven't you all grown again? How big you are, Julian!
Taller than I am, I'd say.
And little Anne, why, she's getting quite big.
That pleased Anne, of course. Julian went back to the front door to help his aunt with the small bags in the trap. The trunks were coming later. Julian and Dick took everything upstairs. Anne joined them, eager to see her old bedroom again. Oh, how good it was to be in Kirin Cottage once more. She looked out of the windows. One looked onto the moor at the back. The other looked sideways onto the sea.
Lovely, lovely.
She began to sing a little song as she undid her bag.
You know,
she said to Dick, when he brought George's bag in.
You know, Dick, I'm really quite pleased that Uncle Quentin has gone to Kirin Island, even if it means we won't be able to go there much. I feel much freer in the house when he's away. He's a very clever man, and he can be awfully nice, but I always feel a bit afraid of him.
Dick laughed. I'm not afraid of him, but he's a bit of a wet blanket in a house, I must say, when we're here for the holidays. Funny to think of him on Kirin Island all alone. A voice came up the stairs. Come down to tea, children, because there are hot scones for you just out of the oven.
Coming, Aunt Fanny, called Dick.
Hurry, Anne, I'm awfully hungry.
Julian, did you hear Aunt Fanny calling?
George came up the stairs to fetch Anne. She was pleased to be home, and as for Timmy, he was engaged in going round every single corner of the house, sniffing vigorously.
He always does that, said George, as if he thought that there might be a chair or a table that didn't smell quite the same as it always did. Come on, Tim, tea time.
Mother, as Father isn't here, can Timmy sit beside me on the floor? He's awfully well behaved now.
Very well, said her mother, and tea began.
What a tea!
It looked as if it was a spread for a party of 20.
Good old Joanna. She must have baked all day.
Well, there wouldn't be much left when the 5 had finished. Chapter 3. Off to Kirin Island. Next day was fine and warm. We can go across to the island this morning, said Aunt Fanny. We'll take our own food, because I'm sure Uncle Quentin will have forgotten we're coming.
Has he a boat there? Asked George. Mother, he hasn't taken my boat, has he?
No, dear, said her mother. He's got another boat. I was afraid he would never be able to get it in and out of all those dangerous rocks round the island. But he got one of the fishermen to take him, and had his own boat towed behind with all its stuff in.
Who built the tower? Asked Julian.
Oh, he made out the plans himself, and some men were sent down from the Ministry of Research to put the tower up for him, said Aunt Fanny. It was all rather hush-hush, really. The people here were most curious about it. But they don't know any more than I do. No local man helped in the building, but one or two fishermen were hired to take the material to the island and to land the men and so on.
It's all very mysterious, said Julian.
Uncle Quentin leads rather an exciting life, really, doesn't he? I wouldn't mind being a scientist myself. I want to be something really worthwhile when I grow up. I'm not just going into somebody's office. I'm going to be on my own.
I think I shall be a doctor, said Dick. I'm off to get my boat, said George, rather bored with this talk. She knew what she was going to do when she was grown up. Live on Kirin Island with Timmy.
Aunt Fanny had got ready plenty of food to take across to the island. She was quite looking forward to the trip. She had not seen her husband for some days and was anxious to know that he was all right. They all went down to the beach, Julian carrying the bag of food. George was already there with her boat. James, a fisher boy friend of George's, was there too, ready to push the boat out for them. He grinned at the children. He knew them all well. In the old days, he had looked after Timmy for George, when her father had said the dog must be given away. George had never forgotten James's kindness to Timmy, and always went to see him every holidays.
Going off to the island, said James.
That's a strange thing in the middle of it, isn't it? Kind of lighthouse it looks.
Oh, take my hand and let me help you in.
Anne took his hand and jumped into the boat. George was already there with Timmy. Soon they were all in. Julian and George took the oars. James gave them a shove and off they went on the calm, clear water. Anne could see every stone on the bottom. Julian and George rowed strongly. They sent the boat along swiftly. George began to sing a rowing song, and they all took it up. It was lovely to be on the sea in a boat again. Oh, holidays, go slowly. Don't rush away too fast. George, said her mother nervously as they came near to Kirin Island, you will be careful of these awful rocks, won't you? The water's so clear today that I can see them all, and some of them are only just below the water.
Oh, Mother, you know I've rowed hundreds of times to Kirin Island, laughed George. I simply couldn't go on a rock. I know them all, really I do. I could almost row blindfold to the island now.
There was only one place to land on the island in safety. This was a little cove, a natural little harbour running up to a stretch of sand. It was sheltered by high rocks all round. George and Julian worked their way to the east side of the island, rounded a low wall of very sharp rocks, and there lay the cove, a smooth inlet of water running into the shore. Anne had been looking at the island as the others rowed. There was the old ruined Kirin Castle in the centre, just the same as ever. Its tumbled-down towers were full of jackdaws as usual. Its old walls were gripped by ivy.
It's a lovely place, said Anne with a sigh.
Then she gazed at the curious tower that now rose from the centre of the castle yard. It was not built of brick, but some smooth, shiny material that was fitted together in sections. Evidently, the tower had been made in that way so that it might be brought to the island easily and set up there quickly.
Isn't it strange? Said Dick. Look at that little glass room at the top, like a lookout room. I wonder what it's for.
Can anyone climb up inside the tower? Asked Dick, turning to Aunt Fanny.
Oh, yes. There is a narrow spiral staircase inside, said his aunt. That's about all there is inside the tower itself. It's the little room at the top that is important. It has got some extraordinary wiring there, essential to your uncle's experiments. I don't think he does anything with the tower. It just has to be there, doing something on its own, which has a certain effect on the experiments he is making. Anne couldn't follow this. It sounded too complicated.
I should like to go up the tower, she said.
Well, perhaps your uncle will let you, said her aunt.
If he's in a good temper, said George.
Now, George, you're not to say things like that, said her mother. The boat ran into the little harbour and grounded softly. There was another boat there already, Uncle Quentin's. George leapt out with Julian, and they pulled it up a little further, so that the others could get out without wetting their feet. Out they all got, and Timmy ran up the beach in delight.
Now,
Timmy, said George warningly, and Timmy turned a despairing eye on his mistress.
Surely she wasn't going to stop him looking to see if there were any rabbits. Only just looking? What harm was there in that? Ah, there was a rabbit. And another. And another. They sat all about, looking at the little company coming up from the shore. They flicked their ears and twitched their noses, keeping quite still.
Oh, they're as tame as ever, said Anne in delight. Aunt Fanny, aren't they lovely? Do look at the baby one over there. He's washing his face.
They stopped to look at the rabbits. They really were astonishingly tame. But then very few people came to Kirin Island, and the rabbits multiplied in peace, running about where they liked, quite unafraid.
Oh, that one is... began Dick.
But then the picture was spoilt. Timmy, quite unable to do nothing but look, had suddenly lost his self-control and was bounding on the surprised rabbits. In a trice, nothing could be seen but white bobtails flashing up and down as rabbit after rabbit rushed to its burrow.
Timmy!
Called George crossly, and poor Timmy put his tail down, looking round at George miserably.
What? He seemed to say. Not even a scamper after the rabbits? What a hard-hearted mistress!
"Where's Uncle Quentin?"
asked Anne, as they walked to the great broken archway that was the entrance to the old castle. Behind it were the stone steps that led towards the centre. They were broken and irregular now. Aunt Fanny went across them carefully, afraid of stumbling, but the children, who were wearing rubber shoes, ran over them quickly. They passed through an old ruined doorway into what looked like a great yard. Once there had been a stone-paved floor, but now most of it was covered by sand and by close-growing weeds or grass. The castle had had two towers. One was almost a complete ruin. The other was in better shape. Jackdaws circled round it and flew above the children's heads, crying, "Chuck, chuck, chuck!"
"I suppose your father lives in the little old room with the two slit-like windows," said Dick to George. "That's the only place in the castle that would give him any shelter. Everywhere else is in ruins except that one room. Do you remember we once spent a night there?"
"Yes," said George. "It was fun. I suppose that's where Father lives. There's nowhere else, unless he's down in the dungeons."
"Oh, no one would live in the dungeon, surely, unless they simply had to," said Julian. "They're so dark and cold. Where is your father, George? I can't see him anywhere."
"Mother, where would Father be?" asked George. "Where's his workshop? In that old room there?"
She pointed to the dark, stone-walled, stone-roofed room, which was really all that was left of the part in which people had long ago lived. It jutted out from what had once been the wall of the castle.
"Well, really, I don't exactly know," said her mother. "I suppose he works over there. He's always met me down at the cove, and we've just sat on the sand and had a picnic and talked. He didn't seem to want me to poke round much."
"Let's call him," said Dick. So they shouted loudly, "Uncle Quentin! Uncle Quentin! Where are you?"
The jackdaws flew up in fright, and a few gulls, who had been sitting on part of the ruined wall, joined in the noise, crying, "Ew, ew, ew!" over and over again. Every rabbit disappeared in a trice. No Uncle Quentin appeared. They shouted again,
"Uncle Quentin! Where are you?"
"Oh, what a noise!" said Aunt Fanny, covering her ears. "I should think that Joanna must have heard that at home. Oh, dear, where is your uncle? This is most annoying of him. I told him I'd bring you across today."
"Oh, well, he must be somewhere about," said Julian cheerfully. "If Mohammed won't come to the mountain, then the mountain must go to Mohammed. I expect he's deep in some book or other. We'll hunt for him."
"We'll look in that little dark room," said Anne.
So they all went through the stone doorway and found themselves in a little dark room, lit only by two slits of windows. At one end was a space, or recess, where a fireplace had once been, going back into the thick stone wall.
"He's not here," said Julian in surprise. "And what's more, there's nothing here at all. No food, no clothes, no books, no stores of any sort. This is not his workroom, nor even his store."
"Then he must be down in the dungeons," said Dick.
"Perhaps it's necessary to his work to be underground and with water all round. Let's go and find the entrance. We know where it is, not far from the old well in the middle of the yard."
"Yes, he must be down in the dungeons, mustn't he, Aunt Fanny?" said Anne. "Are you coming down?"
"Oh, no," said her aunt. "I can't bear those dungeons. I'll sit out here in the sun, in this sheltered corner, and unpack the sandwiches. It's almost lunchtime."
"Oh, good," said everyone.
They went towards the dungeon entrance. They expected to see the big flat stone that covered the entrance standing upright, so that they might go down the steps underground. But the stone was lying flat. Julian was just about to pull on the iron ring to lift it up when he noticed something peculiar.
"Look," he said. There are weeds growing round the edges of the stone. Nobody has lifted it for a long time. Uncle Quentin isn't down in the dungeons.
Then where is he? Said Dick. Wherever can he be?
Chapter 4. Where is Uncle Quentin? The four of them, with Timmy nosing round their legs, stood staring down at the big stone that hid the entrance to the dungeons. Julian was perfectly right. The stone could not have been lifted for months because weeds had grown closely round the edges, sending their small roots into every crack.
No one is down there, said Julian. We need not even bother to pull up the stone and go down to see.
If it had been lifted lately, those weeds would have been torn up as it was raised.
And anyway, we know that no one can get out of the dungeon once the entrance stone is closing it, said Dick. It's too heavy. Uncle Quentin wouldn't be silly enough to shut himself in. He'd leave it open.
Of course he would, said Anne.
Well, he's not there then. He must be somewhere else.
But where? Said George. This is only a small island, and we know every corner of it. Oh, would he be in that cave we hid in once? The only cave on the island?
Oh, yes, he might be, said Julian. But I doubt it. I can't see Uncle Quentin dropping down through the hole in the cave's roof. And that's the only way of getting into it, unless you're going to clamber and slide about the rocks on the shore for ages. I can't see him doing that either.
They made their way beyond the castle to the other side of the island. Here there was a cave they had once lived in. It could be entered with difficulty on the seaward side, as Julian had said, by clambering over slippery rocks, or it could be entered by dropping down a rope through a hole in the roof to the floor some way below. They found the hole half hidden in old heather. Julian felt about. The rope was still there.
"I'll slide down and have a look," he said.
He went down the rope. It was knotted at intervals so that his feet found holding places, and he did not slide down too quickly and scorch his hands. He was soon in the cave. A dim light came in from the seaward side. Julian took a quick look round. There was absolutely nothing there at all, except for an old box that they must have left behind when they were last here themselves. He climbed up the rope again, his head appearing suddenly out of the hole. Dick gave him a hand.
Well, he said, any sign of Uncle Quentin?
No, said Julian. He's not there, and hasn't been there either, I should think. It's a mystery. Where is he? And if he's really doing important work, where is all his stuff? I mean, we know that plenty of stuff was brought here because Aunt Fanny told us so.
Do you think he's in the tower? Said Anne suddenly. He might be in that glass room at the top.
Well, he'd see us at once if he were, said Julian scornfully, and hear our yells too. Still, we might as well have a look.
So back to the castle they went, and walked to the peculiar tower. Their aunt saw them and called to them.
Your lunch is ready. Come and have it. Your uncle will turn up, I expect. But Aunt Fanny, where is he? Said Anne with a puzzled face. We've looked simply everywhere.
Her aunt did not know the island as well as the children did. She imagined that there were plenty of places to shelter in or to work in.
Never mind, she said, looking quite undisturbed. He'll turn up later. You come along and have your meal.
We think we'll go up the tower, said Julian, just in case he's up there working.
The four children and Timmy went to where the tower rose up from the castle yard. They ran their hands over the smooth, shining sections, which were fitted together in curving rows.
What's this stuff it's built of? Said Dick.
Some kind of new plastic material, I should think, said Julian. Very light and strong and easily put together.
I should be afraid it would blow down in a gale, said George.
Yes, so should I, said Dick.
Look, here is the door.
The door was small and rounded at the top. A key was in the keyhole. Julian turned it and unlocked the door. It opened outwards, not inwards. Julian put his head inside and looked round. There was not much room in the tower. A spiral staircase, made of the same shiny stuff as the tower itself, wound up and up and up. There was a space at one side of it, into which projected curious hook-like objects, made of what looked like steel. Wire ran from one to the other.
Better not touch them, said Julian, looking curiously at them. Goodness, this is like a tower out of a fairy tale. Come on, I'm going up the stairs to the top.
He began to climb the steep spiral stairway. It made him quite giddy to go up and round, so many, many times. The others followed him. Tiny, slit-like windows, set sideways, not downwards, were let into the side of the tower here and there and gave a little light to the stairway. Julian looked through one and had a wonderful view of the sea and the mainland. He went on up to the top. When he got there, he found himself in a small round room whose sides were of thick, gleaming glass. Wires ran right into the glass itself and then pierced through it, the free ends waving and glittering in the strong wind that blew round the tower. There was nothing in the little room at all. Certainly Uncle Quentin was not there. It was clearly only a tower meant to take the wires up on the hook-like things and to run them through the strange thick glass at the top and set them free in the air. What for? Were they catching some kind of wireless waves? Was it to do with radar? Julian wondered, frowning, what was the meaning of the tower and the thin, shining wires? The others crowded into the little room. Timmy came too, having managed the spiral stairs with difficulty.
Gracious! What a weird place, said George. My goodness, what a view we've got from here! We can see miles and miles out to sea. And on this other side, we can see miles and miles across the bay, over the mainland to the hills beyond.
Yes, it's lovely, said Anne. But where is Uncle Quentin? We still haven't found him. I suppose he is on the island.
Well, his boat was pulled up in the cove, said George. We saw it.
Then he must be here somewhere, said Dick. But he's not in the castle. He's not in the dungeons. He's not in the cave. And he's not up here. It's a first-class mystery.
The missing uncle. Where is he? Said Julian. Look, there's poor Aunt Fanny still down there, waiting with the lunch. We'd better go down. She's signalling to us.
I should like to, said Anne. It's an awful squash in this tiny glass room. I say, did you feel the tower sway then, when that gust of wind shook it? I'm going down quickly before the whole thing blows over.
She began to go down the spiral stairs, holding on to a little handrail that ran down beside them. The stairs were so steep that she was afraid of falling. She nearly did fall when Timmy pushed his way past her and disappeared below at a remarkably fast pace. Soon they were all down at the bottom. Julian locked the door again.
Not much good locking a door if you leave the key in, he said. Still, I'd better.
They walked over to Aunt Fanny.
Well, I thought you were never coming, she said. Did you see anything interesting up there?
Only a lovely view, said Anne. Simply magnificent. But we didn't find Uncle Quentin. It's very mysterious, Aunt Fanny. We really have looked everywhere on the island, but he's just not here.
And yet his boat is in the cove, said Dick, so he can't have gone.
Yes, it does sound odd, said Aunt Fanny, handing round the sandwiches. But you don't know your uncle as well as I do. He always turns up all right.
He's forgotten I was bringing you, or he would be here. As it is, we may not see him, if he's quite forgotten about your coming. If he remembers, he'll suddenly turn up.
But where from? Asked Dick, munching a potted meat sandwich. He's done a jolly good disappearing trick, Aunt Fanny.
Well, you'll see where he comes from, I've no doubt, when he arrives, said Aunt Fanny.
Another sandwich, George?
No, not you, Timmy. You've had three already. Oh, George, do keep Timmy's head out of that plate.
He's hungry too, Mother, said George.
Well, I've brought dog biscuits for him, said her mother.
Oh, Mother, as if Timmy would eat dog biscuits when he can have sandwiches, said George.
He only eats dog biscuits when there's absolutely nothing else, and he's so ravenous he can't help eating them. They sat in the warm April sunshine, eating hungrily. There was orangeade to drink, cool and delicious. Timmy wandered over to a rock pool he knew, where rainwater collected, and he could be heard lapping there.
"Hasn't he got a good memory?" said George proudly. "It's ages since he was here, and yet he remembered that pool at once when he felt thirsty.
It's funny Timmy hasn't found Uncle Quentin, isn't it?" said Dick suddenly. "I mean, when we were hunting for him and got warm, you'd think Timmy would bark or scrape about or something, but he didn't."
"I think it's jolly funny that Father can't be found anywhere," said George. "I do, really. I can't think how you can take it so calmly, Mother."
"Well, dear, as I said before, I know your father better than you do," said her mother. "He'll turn up in his own good time. Why, I remember once when he was doing some sort of work in the stalactite caves at Cheddar. He disappeared in them for over a week. But he wandered out all right when he had finished his experiments."
"It's very strange," began Anne, and then stopped suddenly.
A curious noise came to their ears, a rumbling, grumbling, angry noise, like a giant hidden dog growling in fury. Then there was a hissing noise from the tower, and all the wires that waved at the top were suddenly lit up as if by lightning. "There now, I knew your father was somewhere about," said George's mother. "I heard that noise when I was here before, but I couldn't make out where it came from."
"Where did it come from?" said Dick. "It sounded almost as if it was underneath us, but it couldn't have been. Gracious, this is most mysterious."
No more noises came. They each helped themselves to buns with jam in the middle. And then Anne gave a squeal that made them all jump violently.
"Look! There's Uncle Quentin, standing over there near the tower. He's watching the jackdaws. Wherever did he come from?"
Chapter 5. A Mystery. Everyone stared at Uncle Quentin. There he was, intently watching the jackdaws, his hands in his pockets. He hadn't seen the children or his wife. Timmy leapt to his feet and gambolled over to George's father. He barked loudly. Uncle Quentin jumped and turned round. He saw Timmy, and then he saw all the others staring at him in real astonishment. Uncle Quentin did not look particularly pleased to see anyone. He walked slowly over to them, a slight frown on his face.
"This is a surprise," he said. "I had no idea you were all coming today."
"Oh, Quentin," said his wife reproachfully. "I wrote it down for you in your diary. You know I did."
"Did you? Well, I haven't looked at my diary since, so it's no wonder I forgot," said Uncle Quentin, a little peevishly.
He kissed his wife, George and Anne, and shook hands with the boys.
"Uncle Quentin, where did you come from?" asked Dick, who was eaten up with curiosity. "We've looked for you for ages."
"Oh, I was in my workroom," said Uncle Quentin vaguely.
"Well, but where's that?" demanded Dick. "Honestly, Uncle, we can't imagine where you hid yourself.
We even went up the tower to see if you were in that funny glass room at the top.
What?
Exploded his uncle in sudden, surprising fury. You dared to go up there? You might have been in great danger. I've just finished an experiment, and all those wires in there were connected with it.
Yes, we saw them acting a bit strangely, said Julian.
You've no business to come over here and interfere with my work, said his uncle, still looking furious. How did you get into that tower? I locked it.
Yes, it was locked all right, said Julian. But you left the key in, you see, Uncle, so I thought it wouldn't matter if...
Oh, so that's where the key is it? Said his uncle. I thought I'd lost it.
Well, don't you ever go into that tower again. I tell you, it's dangerous.
Uncle Quentin, you haven't told us yet where your workroom is, said Dick, who was quite determined to know. We can't imagine where you suddenly came from.
I told them you'd turn up, Quentin, said his wife.
You look a bit thin, dear. Have you been having regular meals? You know, I left plenty of good soup to heat up.
Did you? Said her husband. Well, I don't know if I've had it or not. I don't worry about meals when I'm working. I'll have some of those sandwiches now, though, if nobody else wants them.
He began to devour the sandwiches, one after another, as if he was ravenous. Aunt Fanny watched him in distress.
Oh, Quentin, you're starving.
I shall come over here and stay and look after you. Her husband looked alarmed. Oh, no, nobody is to come here. I can't have my work interfered with. I'm working on an extremely important discovery.
Is it a discovery that nobody else knows about?
Asked Anne, her eyes wide with admiration.
How clever Uncle Quentin was.
Well, I'm not sure about that,
said Uncle Quentin, taking two sandwiches at once.
That's partly why I came over here, besides the fact that I wanted water round me and above me. I have a feeling that somebody knows a bit more than I want them to know. But there's one thing. They can't come here unless they're shown the way through all those rocks that lie round the island. Only a few of the fishermen know that, and they've been given orders not to bring anyone here at all. I think you're the only other person that knows the way, George.
Uncle Quentin, please do tell us where your workroom is, begged Dick, feeling that he could not wait a single moment more to solve the mystery.
Don't keep bothering your uncle, said his aunt annoyingly. Let him eat his lunch. He can't have had anything for ages.
Yes, but Aunt Fanny, I...
began Dick, and was interrupted by his uncle.
You obey your aunt, young man. I don't want to be pestered by any of you. What does it matter where I work?
Oh, it doesn't really matter a bit, said Dick hurriedly. It's only that I'm awfully curious to know. You see, we looked for you simply everywhere.
Well, you're not quite so clever as you thought you were then, said Uncle Quentin, and reached for a jammy bun. George, take this dog of yours away from me. He keeps breathing down my neck, hoping I shall give him a titbit. I don't approve of titbits at mealtimes.
George pulled Timmy away. Her mother watched her father gobbling up the rest of the food. Most of the sandwiches she had saved for tea time had gone already. Poor Quentin. How very hungry he must be.
Quentin, you don't think there's any danger for you here, do you? She said. I mean, you don't think anyone would try to come spying on you, as they did once before?
No. How could they? Said her husband. No plane can land on this island. No boat can get through the rocks, unless the way is known, and the sea's too rough round the rocks for any swimmer.
Julian, see if you can make him promise to signal to me night and morning, said Aunt Fanny, turning to her nephew. I feel worried about him somehow.
Julian tackled his uncle manfully.
Uncle, it wouldn't be too much of a bother to you to signal to Aunt Fanny twice a day, would it?
If you don't, Quentin, I shall come over every single day to see you,
said his wife.
And we might come too, said Anne mischievously.
Her uncle looked most dismayed at the idea.
Well, I could signal in the morning and in the evening when I go up to the top of the tower, he said. I have to go up once every 12 hours to readjust the wires. I'll signal then, 10:30 in the morning and 10:30 at night.
How will you signal? Asked Julian. Will you flash with a mirror in the morning?
Yes, that would be quite a good idea, said his uncle. I could do that easily. And I'll use a lantern at night. I'll shine it out 6 times at 10:30. Then perhaps you'll all know I'm all right and will leave me alone. But don't look for the signal tonight. I'll start tomorrow morning.
Oh, Quentin, dear, you do sound cross, said his wife. I don't like you being all alone here, that's all. You look thin and tired. I'm sure you're not...
Uncle Quentin put on a scowl, exactly like George sometimes put on. He looked at his wristwatch.
Well, I must go, he said. Time to get to work again. I'll see you to your boat.
We're going to stay to tea here, Father, said George.
No, I'd rather you didn't, said her father, getting up. Come on, I'll take you to your boat.
But, Father, I haven't been on my island for ages, said George indignantly. I want to stay here a bit longer. I don't see why I shouldn't.
Well, I've had enough interruption to my work, said her father. I want to get on.
We shan't disturb you, Uncle Quentin, said Dick, who was still terribly curious to know where his uncle had his workroom. Why wouldn't he tell them? Was he just being annoying, or didn't he want them to know?
Uncle Quentin led them all firmly towards the little cove. It was plain that he meant them to go, and to go quickly.
When shall we come over and see you again, Quentin? Asked his wife.
Not till I say so, said her husband. It won't take me long now to finish what I'm on. Oh, my word, that dog's got a rabbit at last.
Oh, Timmy!
Yelled George in distress. Timmy dropped the rabbit he had actually managed to grab. It scampered away unhurt. Timmy came back to his mistress looking very sheepish.
You're a very bad dog. Just because I took my eye off you for 1/2 a second. No, it's no good licking my hand like that. I'm cross.
They all came to the boat.
I'll push her off, said Julian. Get in, all of you. Well, goodbye, Uncle Quentin. I hope your work goes well.
Everyone got into the boat. Timmy tried to put his head on George's knee, but she pushed it away.
Oh, be kind to him and forgive him, begged Anne. He looks as if he's going to cry.
Are you ready? Cried Julian. Got the oars, George? Dick, take the other pair.
He shoved the boat off and leapt in himself. He cupped his hands round his mouth.
Don't forget to signal. We'll be watching out morning and evening.
And if you forget, I shall come over the very next day,
called his wife. The boat slid away down the little inlet of water, and Uncle Quentin was lost to sight. Then round the low wall of rocks went the boat, and was soon on the open sea.
Jew, watch and see if you can make out where Uncle Quentin is when we're round these rocks, said Dick. See what direction he goes in.
Julian tried to see his uncle, but the rocks just there hid the cove from sight, and there was no sign of him at all.
Why didn't he want us to stay?
Because he didn't want us to know his hiding place, said Dick.
And why doesn't he want us to know?
Because it's somewhere we don't know either.
But I thought we knew every single corner of my island, said George. I think it's mean of Father not to tell me if it's somewhere I don't know. I can't think where it can be.
Timmy put his head on her knee again. George was so absorbed in trying to think where her father's hiding place could be that she absent-mindedly stroked Timmy's head. He was almost beside himself with delight. He licked her fingers lovingly.
Oh, Timmy, I didn't mean to pet you for ages, said George.
stop licking my hands. You make them feel wet and horrid.
Dick, it's very mysterious, isn't it? Where can Father be hiding?
I can't imagine, said Dick. He looked back at the island. A cloud of jackdaws rose up into the air, calling loudly, Jack, Jack, Jack!
The boy watched them. What had disturbed them? Was it Uncle Quentin? Perhaps his hiding place was somewhere about that old tower then, the one the jackdaws nested in. On the other hand, the jackdaws often rose into the air together, for no reason at all.
Those jackdaws were making a bit of a fuss, he said. Perhaps Uncle's hiding place is not far from where they roost together, by that tower.
Can't be, said Julian. We went all round there today.
Well, it's a mystery, said George gloomily. And I think it's horrible having a mystery about my very own island and to be forbidden to go to it and solve it. It's really too bad.
End of Disc 1.